Hello and welcome to Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions, where we talk about scientific misconceptions we all have, and we hope that you learn something new about the world. I'm here with my co-host, Camden, have yourself a merry little, Hanslick Burton.
And I'm here with my co-host, Margaret, grubby little mitts, Hanslick Burton.
Welcome to the show! Our first segment every week is where we share something that we are excited about. Can I go first?
Yeah.
I'd like to go first.
Is it the same? Do we have the same one?
No. I'm going to mention one. Maybe you should go first. Go ahead.
Margaret, you ever ridden a horse?
Yes.
Well, we're back on it. We're back on the horse.
Recently, I've been thinking about how I don't know if I really like horses as transportation anymore. So can we think of a different...
For us, no one needs to do it anymore.
Yeah, for you and me, yes. Yeah. Yes.
The pod is back. We did it.
Hooray! It's only been a week.
Well, it's only been one episode since the last episode.
Sorry we didn't have an episode last week, y'all.
Yeah, sorry we missed a week,
but we are back on the horse. I can't think of a different one. Back on the horse.
Margaret?
I am excited about the fact that it is finally cold. I am sitting here in a sweater with my house slippies on, and I have been drinking a mug of froth, which is...
Wow, you really admitted that?
Yeah. I put milk and a little bit of creamer in the frother at nighttime because I can't have more coffee. And I drink it, and it's all foamy. It's delicious. I can't recommend it highly enough. And you get the added bonus of your husband just making fun of you all day long.
Even before the froth part
happens.
Yeah,
he knows it's coming. He knows it's coming, and he is ready to ridicule. So that's what I'm excited about, but I'm also excited about being back on the horse with you. We've got to go to our next segment, Camden.
Let's go.
No time to be wasted. What is our next segment? Thank you, guest, visitor. I will tell you. It is, what's that sound? Camden, jingle, please go.
Ding, 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 ding. Da-don, don, don, da-don, don. Not copyright infringement.
Wonderful. This is What Is That Sound, where we keep with the spirit of the show. So one of us researches a sound that the other one is not aware of. And this time Camden has found a sound that I have no idea what he's going to have me listen to. And I'm going to have to guess what it is. The sounds we share are typically scientific in nature in some way. Camden, what do you have for us?
All right. Are you ready for the first clip?
Yep. Okay, I'm going to say, I don't know what, I mean, I do know why, because the ocean is a mysterious place. Every single sound that you ever play for me, I assume is happening underwater. I picture maybe something moving along the seabed, the tectonic plates crunching up against each other. That's what I'm going to go with.
Okay. I'm going to give you a second listen and tell you that you are cold.
The second listen did not clarify anything for me.
Really didn't.
There wasn't a tiny voice going, I'm actually a barnacle.
A what kind of voice?
Tiny. It's Rick Moranis in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah, that's background noise. Scientific. From Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
I know a tiny. Okay, you said tiny. I'm going to go with this. It's the magnified sound of a chitin scraping algae off of a rock.
It is the amplified sound of something. It is the amplified sound of a yeast's cell walls.
What? What if I had gotten that?
And then you looked at the show notes. Gosh,
I know exactly what that is. I've heard it a million times.
So a yeast is a unicellular fungus.
Mm-hmm.
So not, not like our human cells, which are animal cells, not like a plant cell or bacteria, but a fungus cell. But it's one cell. And this was feeling the oscillations from an electron force microscope touching the cell and feeling it like moving.
So it's like the vibrations of the cell wall
itself. And the reason they were doing this is because they hope to one day be able to do this with human cells, because the way a cell moves might be different in cancerous cells versus regular behaving cells. So this could be a way to use sound to detect, a less invasive way to detect maybe abnormalities going on with cells.
Wow.
Which is really cool. And I think the idea is that you wouldn't necessarily need a microscope each time, but maybe be able to like have a machine that like detects the sounds of your cells and whether they're behaving normally or not, which is really cool.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's so cool.
So that was fungus cells or yeast cells.
Yeast cells. Thank you. Nice. All right, well, it's time to go on to the main segment of our show, which are, of course, the misconceptions. If you've joined us before, you know that every week we have prepared separately a misconception, scientific misconception. We haven't told each other what it is, and we are going to share them with you, and the other person's going to be learning along right with you, the audience. So we always flip a coin of some kind to determine who goes first. Camden has in his hand a Model Magic Ritz cracker that I made as part of a Lunchables Model Magic coaster set. The little air holes up is the heads, would you say?
Yeah, the regular cracker side is heads.
And the flatter side.
The flat underside is tails.
So you're going to toss it, and if I get it right, then I go first?
Are you calling heads?
Yeah, I'm going to call heads.
Getting it right for a tail coin flip is was unclear.
I'm get it right.
Is heads.
Yes.
You win.
Thank you. Well, the reason I especially wanted to go first today is because you basically provided an incredible transition into my misconception. What did you say the cell walls were from?
A yeast.
Which is what? A type of?
Fungus.
Thank you. Yes. So.
Is this all about sounds that fungus make? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. No, no, it's not. So. As you know, one of the many shows that I still need to finish, like Schitt's Creek, like Our Flag Means Death, is...
In Broad City.
Broad City, yep. For some reason, I just can't... I savor things too long. Yeah. I don't want them to end, and then I never return to them.
And then you forget everything that happened.
Forget everything, and I have to watch the whole thing from the beginning. One of the shows like that is The Last of Us, a video game I very much enjoyed, now a TV show starring Pedro Pascal. On HBO. Loved it, savoring it too much, need to return to it. But watching that show does make it a little difficult to enjoy a food that I usually love. And I'm talking about mushrooms, which are a type of fungi. There are more than 10,000 known varieties of mushrooms. Did you know that?
Of just mushrooms?
10,000, yes.
Holy smokes.
Of just mushrooms.
I kind of lose track of, you know, whenever there's like an animal kingdom or like any reference to like, there's 50 billion kinds of beetles and there's like 5 billion types of birds. Mm-hmm. These numbers are not accurate. I'm always like, I can't like, to me, it's just impressive when someone's like, I've memorized 350 types of birds.
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend at some point. But yes, 10,000 known varieties of mushrooms. And Camden, mushrooms are a vegetable, right? I don't know.
No.
But we know they're
like
not
in the food world.
We know they're not plants, right?
Yes.
Or are they?
What?
We'll find out today. Do you see what I'm doing?
I see what you're doing.
Yeah. Wow. What? What's going on? My citations for this misconception are varied. There's the American Society for Microbiology, of course, our beloved friend Wikipedia, a Harvard T.H. Chan School for Public Health article, and Agwal and Victor Fugoni's article in the journal Food and Nutrition Research. I really combed the web for this. So, Let's talk about classification. Why do we classify things, Camden? Why is that helpful?
It's a way to organize life mm-hmm. so that we know that we can all have like a common language of, you know, what we're referencing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say like scientists and even like, you know, it's helpful to say, you know, in this country, you might have a colloquial name for, you know, this bird and mm-hmm. another that might have it, but there's one scientific name and it's classified so that we also know the evolutionary history and how these things might be related.
And for the most part, we also know common characteristics they're going to have.
Yep.
Right?
So yeah, if they're all a mammal, then you can be sure they're going to have some things in common.
Mm-hmm. Hair, fur, live birth, etc. Yeah. So it's helpful to let us quickly be able to know generally the commonalities and all the reasons you mentioned. The way that we categorize organisms can change, though, as we learn more about that organism and other related organisms. There's many examples of this. A long time ago, people thinking that something was related when we find out later, based on more data and more evidence, that it's not. Carl Linnaeus, famous scientist and infamous racist, originally
yep.
put all living things into two categories, which were plants and animals.
Easy.
Easy. Easy. We love categorizing things. Sometimes they make things too easy and therefore untrue. So for many years, many, many, many years, mushrooms were solidly placed in the plant category, which I don't blame scientists for, right?
If you ask like a three-year-old,
they're going to say they're
like,
plant.
Which there's a plant, there's a mushroom, mm-hmm. and tell me which one, that, like an animal, which one is this closest to?
Yeah. Plant. Yeah. And when you think about it, when these classifications were originally made, the microscope hadn't been invented yet. DNA analysis would have been considered witchcraft, I assume. I don't have a citation for that. But, so they were working off very little information. But mushrooms were the first types of fungi, getting back to fungi, that scientists studied and categorized.
Okay. That makes sense.
There's 10,000 species of them.
And people were already probably eating those.
Right.
And had a clearer idea of like, we all agree this is a mushroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So by looking closely at mushrooms, those early scientists made some conclusions about fungi in general. They thought that fungi couldn't move on their own and had stiff cell walls that held their shape, speaking of cell walls. And that was good enough for most early scientists to realize that fungi are not animals, so what's the other option?
Plant.
They've got to be plants.
And to add something to this, maybe mm-hmm. you're going to say, it's plants do have stiff cell walls also, mm-hmm. and animals don't.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. So in reality, though, we now know that some fungi can move around. And modern cool. scientists now know that fungi are very different in other ways from plants and animals. So why, Camden, aren't fungi like plants?
Why? Well, they don't photosynthesize.
Yes, that's enough from you right
okay,
now. Okay,
that's
so much.
Quiet you.
So what do you think they lack?
A chloroplast.
That's correct. Yes, fungi don't have chloroplasts. Chloroplasts, as I believe Kim was about to say, they are a defining feature of plants that allow what to happen?
Photosynthesis.
Photosynthesis. While some plants have lost chloroplasts over the evolutionary scale. They've lost them. Fungi never had them. They didn't lose them. They never had them.
Can't lose what's never there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, old-timey fungi. And speaking of photosynthesis, fungi get their food differently than plants. So plants, of course, we talked about, use photosynthesis to make their own food using sunlight, carbon dioxide, and water. But fungi don't do that. Instead, they release these special enzymes. Can you describe an enzyme, Camden?
Enzymes are special proteins that help speed up like reactions. So like if you've ever seen like an apple will decompose mm-hmm. very slowly. Mm-hmm. But when you put it in your tummy and you throw a bunch of enzymes at it, you start getting it to break down even faster so that you can have its nutrients and you don't have to wait like, you know, a month for that apple to fall apart in your tummy.
Exactly. Fall apart in your tummy. So, yes. So fungi use special enzymes that break down materials around them. They then soak up those broken down bits and they keep them or they absorb them as nutrients. So they kind of do it outside their bodies. They are getting food from outside of their bodies, unlike plants that are making their own. This different way of getting food was a super important clue that fungi are not the same as plants, even though people used to group them together. That was one clue that told them that how they feed shows that fungi should be in their own category, separate from plants altogether. Because that's pretty key, right? Like how someone eats, how something eats, how it gets food.
Especially in the sense of plants and animals, right. Where plants have the ability to make their own food, that's a pretty key characteristic to not have and still try to call it a plant.
Right. So then scientists have since, not Carl Linnaeus, he didn't do this, they've used computer models, Linnaeus could only dream, to analyze the genetic code for different living things. So those models suggest that fungi and animals share an ancestor, which means a single organism they both came from. Let's call her Deborah. they share that ancestor more recently than fungi share one with plants.
Which is wild.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at any mold growing on your bread or a mushroom in the field or a little
yeast. We have more in common with
that
than...
That thing's like your first cousin. That plant in your fridge is like your second cousin.
Exactly. And we all should be very proud of that. This is why fungi and animals are grouped into their own category called... Bum, ba, da, bum, 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 bum. Do you know what it is, Camden?
No, I forget.
It's called opithoscons. Opithoscons. No, I think I'm right. Okay. Opithoscons. Editing Camden can decide if he wants to keep my attempts in here. But opithoscons. So this grouping is supported by evidence like fungi cells and animal sperm cells. They have this tail-like structure in the back, which plant cells don't have. So again, those fungi cells and animal sperm cells have that tail. Plant cells don't have that at any point. So what are mushrooms and other fungi if they're not plants? They're not animals.
They're fungi.
They're their own thing.
And their own thing.
They are fungi, which is a separate kingdom from animals and plants. But like we said, fungi lean more toward the animal kingdom than the plant kingdom because both animals and fungi are heterotrophs, meaning that they can't make their own food. But they don't share all of their traits with either plants or animals. That's why they get their own kingdom. Yet another thing that Carl Linnaeus was wrong about. What else is new?
The hit job.
But we know fungi are their own thing.
Okay.
If we're classifying them, their own kingdom.
And we have.
But are they vegetables?
Oh, wait, you mean like in the food sense?
Yeah.
I have a real issue with vegetables because in my brain. That nobody likes the science teacher's take on a fruit because a tomato is a fruit because it has seeds and a potato is a vegetable because it doesn't.
Yeah, I have in my notes here, if you've ever argued with someone about whether or not is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable, you know the contentious nature of culinary classification.
Yeah.
And that is, I feel like, where all of us hear for the first time a kid, maybe it's us going... Actually, like that's the first time. Actually, did you know a tomato is a fruit? And everyone's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Stop, who cares? We don't cook it like a fruit. If we're talking about culinary classifications.
What do you call it then?
Well, so I looked at a lot of different sources and it seems that whether or not a mushroom counts as a vegetable in cooking is kind of nebulous. Many cooks call them vegetables, but again, they're not plants. So technically they can again be in their own non-fruit, non-vegetable category.
Good for
They're
them.
Neither. They are mushrooms. They are their own thing. So I learned a lot about mushrooms through this research, and I welcome you to share this information with other people. I wouldn't recommend sharing these facts at a party, though, since you probably want to be seen as a fun guy.
Oh, we almost made it, huh?
P.S.
Oh.
Truffles aren't mushrooms. What? Sorry.
Wait, what are they?
Sorry. They are an entirely different kind of fungus because they grow underground, while mushrooms do not.
You're just going to leave us with that?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, that's about it. That's I don't think fact. I can make a misconception about truffles. Are truffles mushrooms? No.
Dang, got hit with a mini misconception on the way out the door.
So there you go. There's a little, I'd say 1.5 for one.
Wow. Thanks, Margaret.
Of course.
Jeebie beebies.
My favorite mushrooms? Thanks for asking.
Oh.
I love a lion's mane. I love an oyster.
Mushroom.
Yeah. Not a animal to eat. Those are probably my top, but I'll really try any mushroom.
Right.
Not any mushroom, but I'll try any.
Right into the show. Cooking mushroom. With your favorite mushrooms.
Yeah, let us know your favorite mushrooms. Really, though, if you want to email us and tell us your favorite ways to cook mushrooms, I love new ways to cook mushrooms.
Yeah, mushrooms are a magic food.
Okay, Camden, I've done mine. Now,
all right, it's your Margaret, time to shine. It's my time to shine.
Uh-huh. I'm going to drink my froth.
And it's get right up into the mic. And Margaret, it's that time of year. It's cold outside. We got our first snow recently.
Oh, good froth.
When you would go outside after a really big snow, what did you enjoy doing outside?
I liked sledding because our backyard had a slight hill.
Do you ever try to build anything with snow?
Relationships with my siblings.
Snow forts or?
Sometimes, a couple things. Mostly snowmen, though. We weren't into architecture as much as we were into creating life out of snow.
Well, Margaret, what about igloos?
Mm-hmm. What about them?
What are igloos made of?
They are made of snow. They're made of snow. Ice. They're made of snow.
All right,
ice.
Margaret, we're going to take on the misconception. What are igloos made of? So this misconception, a lot of my research came from a lot of the references coming from Wikipedia and some of the summary, because I will forever stand on the fact that Wikipedia is a great place to start from.
Yes, it is.
The book, A Lost Art in the Arctic, Igloo Making, an article that How Does Ice Cool Drinks, BBC Teach and Cornell University.
Nice.
Margaret, a lot of people think that an igloo is like a brick house with brick and mortar, where the bricks are made out of
snow
and the ice is made out of
snow water.
So a lot of people, when they had interviewed like kids in some of these, and
did I get it wrong? Well, here's the deal.
It's not that you got it wrong. It's just that you might just hold a different misconception about this, or sometimes our misconceptions are just like,
ice.
I don't know. I've never
made
thought
out of
about
ice.
This.
They're made out of ice.
They think about the bricks as ice.
Okay.
And so
you stacked up a bunch of ice cubes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they think about snow as mortar, because you think about, okay, the snow is like something you can pack down, but an ice block is, you know, like a brick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's eventually what, you know, creates the igloo house and allows you to stay warm. Well, Margaret.
What?
An igloo is only made of one thing.
Love.
Love and snow.
Two things.
It's only made of snow.
Oh. Now, I will say, I didn't think it was only snow.
It's only snow.
Oh, wow.
But a lot of people, I thought it was like ice and snow.
Mm-hmm.
Because
my neighbors would build igloos.
Yeah.
Like pretty impressive igloos, and those were all made of snow. Now, would they withstand the test of time? Absolutely not.
So I've got, I think, four mini misconceptions for you in this one.
Oh my goodness.
I have mini misconception one. When do indigenous folks who would have built igloos, when would they have used an igloo? When do they use igloos?
In the winter?
Yes. For how long?
Actually, I take that back. I would have thought maybe like the whole year.
Yes. So I would have thought that I was always taught an igloo is a house.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a yurt. It's like, you know,
it's a structure.
It's an ice tent.
Yeah.
It is a temporary structure used for folks who are traveling through some of the coldest regions of the Arctic Circle. for indigenous folks who might have been hunting or fishing, but for some reason working in those areas, it was not a permanent housing structure.
Oh, see, I would have thought, it would have been.
I would have thought it too. So that is misconception number one. They are not a permanent housing structure. And Margaret, I'm going to ask you another mini misconception.
Please.
How many holes are there in an igloo?
One, maybe two.
The answer is two. Where are those two holes?
One is the entrance / exit and one is the top.
Yes. Four.
Fire.
Ventilation.
Smoke to come out.
Yes. Ventilation. There's an entrance and a ventilation hole. As you probably could guess, the ventilation hole, you mentioned fire, keeps fresh air cycling. It actually also prevents it from getting too humid.
Because and melting, I feel like, then.
Melting a bit. And also just if you are in an igloo that is made out of snow, which is water, you don't want it to become humid.
Oh, my gosh.
And,
yeah,
like, everything you're wearing becomes wet. On top of people being cold, you're going in there to get dry and warmer. So one thing to also know, maybe a mini misconception is, like, do all Inuit peoples use igloos? We kind of already went through this. No, they were traditionally used only by folks of Canada's central Arctic and northwest regions of Greenland near the Arctic Circle. So really it was just very few
in Greenland.
Greenland.
Oh, I didn't think. I thought it was a American continent sort of situation.
I thought it was a North America. I guess Greenland might be North America. I don't know. Oh.
No, it's its own thing.
I know, but I just meant, like, what is just Greenland?
Oh, I see. No, I wouldn't. If you had said, are there igloos in Greenland, I would have said probably not.
So it says the Northwest region.
This is my fault.
But even just anywhere very close to the Arctic Circle in Greenland and North America, only were there certain nations, folks from there who would use igloos. And I feel like I was erroneously told or made to believe that just if you lived in the cold and you were an indigenous person, you built an igloo.
Oh yes, I would have erroneously believed that.
Obviously,
as well.
That has some, like, weird white child teachings and messed up stuff in it. But yeah. So a science lesson, Margaret, about water and heat. So when matter is frozen in a solid, it makes a crystal structure, a crystalline structure. So it's very uniform. Like if you look at it molecularly.
Yes.
Like the atoms, like it looks very well packed together. This allows heat as energy to travel in between those. So if you imagine like you had created a marshmallow structure out of, maybe you remember from grade school making like crystalline structures, like
out of marshmallows and toothpicks.
Well, like marshmallows and toothpicks. There's a lot of gaps, right?
Yes.
So heat can pass through that really easily. So this is actually why they use snow. Snow is not packed, as it is not crystalline. It's still sort of in this like frozen water, like liquid
ice stage.
There's a
little bit of
stage.
Give to it.
So there's wiggle. So the heat is actually getting trapped more easily in it.
Oh.
It also means air is within snow. So that's also what makes snow lighter. There is air trapped in there, and air is a really good insulator.
Okay.
Which is...
Yeah, air is a really good insulator. That's why, like, our coats that we got from Costco, not sponsored, basically create an air layer. They're not they're not that thick themselves, but they have space in between.
Correct. And so basically the snow is kind of working double by not being a very easy structure for heat to go through. And it also has air, which is sort of weird. I think when we think of snow, you don't think of you're also like holding air, which is a weird concept, but air is packed in there too, which makes it a much better insulator. So igloos stay warm. They can trap air within them, within the snow walls, if you will. And then here is my last mini misconception. What shape are igloos?
I'm going to say either octagonal or circular.
So I think a lot of people imagine a semicircle, like a half sphere.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's what I picture.
With a little door, yep, or like a little arched like door that you crawl through.
Yes. That is what I picture.
So actually it is a parabolic dish. Basically, I'm trying to think of like...
I cannot picture that.
Well, like a ball. I'm trying to think of something that is shaped like a dish. Like a, if you've ever seen like a TV, like those old like dish network.
Oh, a dish. Not like an eating dish.
Not an eating dish. What do you call... What's another thing that has that kind of shape? Like a flattened dome.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, like a mound almost.
Like a squished... half circle, half yes, sphere.
It's not a perfect half sphere. Mm-hmm. It's sort of squished down.
It's not like an ice cream scoop.
No. Mm-hmm. Man, I wish I had like an example of a good...
We have a lot of domes in here, unfortunately. Yes.
But bowl, like a cereal bowl, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually not usually a perfect mm-hmm. half a circle, mm-hmm. but it's a little squished down. The reason for that is basically the less surface area you have means the less opportunities for heat loss. So if you think about it, the further, the more that is exposed to the wind and the air outside,
right,
the more opportunities for losing heat. So you really don't want it to be that tall. You don't want that much space up above. And I'm kind of giving you a hint by saying the word up above.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm hinting at?
Heaven.
Igloos are built into the ground also. So when you see, which makes sense, right? When you think about like what would like help protect you mm-hmm. from the wind and losing heat.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just a dome on top of the ground, you are more likely to, you know, have a lot of wind hitting the sides and losing heat.
Mm-hmm.
So they are sort of as much as you can. I mean, that's frozen ground. So right. They're not digging like, don't think about like an underground cave, but they're trying to make it as little as possible being exposed to the elements up mm-hmm. above.
Interesting.
So the door is actually a little hole that you crawl down into and into the igloo itself.
Wow.
Because you really don't want the door just like have like an open hole that just shoots wind into you.
No.
For those who might not know, it's very windy up there. The wind can be as bad as the cold.
Yeah.
Well,
that what you've said about the shape of it makes a lot of sense because I, before this, was thinking about how when I thought of an igloo, I thought of like a vaulted ceiling almost.
Yes.
But as anyone who has a big, like high ceiling, it's hard to heat that.
Yes.
It's hard to, that's a lot of space to keep warm. Yeah. So that would not be effective at all.
Yeah. When you think about an igloo, you really just want as much space as possible for you to fit in. Mm-hmm. You don't want a bunch of extra space that you're heating that isn't, you just want to be hot.
Right.
That also the blocks of snow, I always thought that, I guess this is another mini misconception, that they were always built like, imagine just like block, 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 mm-hmm. block, top row, new row, block, block, block.
Yeah.
It's actually built in a spiral, like a cone that spirals up until the top is just one little block.
I'm going to need to Google pictures of this, yeah. I think.
Yeah, imagine like... if you were, okay, you know how you make an ice cream cone?
Mm-hmm.
Like you're spiraling it sort of like as it goes upwards. Mm. You're not spiraling it in a perfect like horizontal, like one layer of ice cream, second layer of ice cream. It's like piling on each other mm-hmm. in a one continuous loop.
Wow.
That adds strength to the igloo too mm-hmm. and prevents there from being like holes and draft spots in there as well, which wow. I thought was interesting. Yeah. But basically, like I said, people dig into it. You enter an igloo by going down and then up into it. There's usually a little platform to sleep on because you don't want to be touching the ground.
Yeah.
People, like you mentioned, cook inside mm-hmm. them. That's what also helps it warm or stay warm. And also there's a platform because then it kind of allows you to be off the ground. It allows you to be nearer to the heat because heat rises.
Mm-hmm.
They did this experiment in Cornell to figure out how warm an igloo actually got. In this experiment, the outside was negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oof.
Which you might imagine is cold.
Yeah, I can't imagine it, but...
inside, the air right next to the walls was 34 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So already negative 40 on the outside of the walls, negative or regular. They're positive 34, just slightly above freezing, touching the walls.
That's incredible.
In the middle, like middle area in between the wall and the fire, mm-hmm. was 61 degrees.
Oh my gosh.
And the air immediately near the skin of the person in the igloo was 97 degrees. So if you think that was only 1 degree cooler than what their body temperature is at.
Well,
one or ish degrees, but like that's what in that wildly, mm-hmm. In that
effective.
Amazing.
That's incredibly effective
that anyone in the Arctic Circle would be anywhere near mm-hmm. that temperature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. I think it was really cool. It's really amazing always to learn how much science has been understood for thousands of years, by Native peoples all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So like anyone in North America, this is not probably that new for folks, but most of us live on stolen land of indigenous people here in North America and probably wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you've lived on that land. People lived on that land for centuries before our country even existed in the United States. So if you go to the website native/land.ca, you can find out what land you actually currently occupy.
Mm-hmm.
You can type in where it'll tell you. You can participate in something known as land reparations, a practice of paying rent.
That's what I was going to say. We do that.
Which we do that. You can pay rent, so to speak, to indigenous peoples who had lived there, to their tribal nations. And you can also educate yourself on other ways that you can participate and give back. In resource generation at resourcegeneration.org.
Thanks, Camden.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I know we're on Osage land, so we pay rent to an Osage foundation.
Through a donation to them.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
For folks who might be like, what do you mean you pay rent?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we don't. We didn't set up like a rental agreement. But thank you so much. I can't wait to Google images of igloos.
Yeah, I realized some of the spiraling that was really interesting. And just a picture of the inside of an igloo is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, now it is time to end with something that we are consuming in some way, reading, watching, interested in. You want to go first, Camden?
Yeah. We've been playing the game It Takes Two, which is, we have it on Steam. We've been playing it on our PC. It's really fun. As you might guess, it is a co-op game for two people. The premise is sort of sad.
Well, we haven't gotten to the end.
We don't know
if the ending.
But
so
the premise, at least the setup, is that you are a husband and wife who are going to get divorced, and then you get shrunk down.
Your daughter is very sad about
your
this.
Your daughter is very sad.
It's really fun.
And then you get shrunk down, and you have to interact with these different worlds and puzzles and all these things to try to basically become unshrunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the game is leading itself towards, oh, through cooperation, they're going to be happy again.
I disagree. I think they're going to learn that.
This is why they should be separated.
Well, no, I think they're going to learn, like, we don't need to be together, but we can be, like, civil and still work together.
I guess because, yeah, they're not really learning their lesson yet.
No. I don't know if there's a lesson to be learned. Anyway,
it's
a lot of fun. It's really fun. It's very fun.
It's a fun game to play.
Yeah, it's very, very fun.
Despite the background to it. It Takes Two.
It Takes Two. Thank you, Margaret. Yeah, I've just been consuming and reading a lot of things about the Gaza Strip recently and about everything going on there. And I really strongly encourage people and a reminder to myself to take action on the behalf of people in Palestine who are suffering worse than we can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And I know that's a really not even sad, like beyond what we can imagine way to talk at the end of the show, but it's just, we can't ignore it. We can't ignore the genocide that's happening. So I really encourage you to get involved on your local level with pro-Palestine groups in Kansas City. There's a lot of great resources. But just take that sort of helpless, overwhelmed feeling and take action with it. Even just a couple actions a day, calling your representatives to demand a ceasefire. There's so much you can do. So,
and if, yeah, like you're saying, if you feel entirely overwhelmed, it's very easy in this world, I think. And that's sort of the point. People want you to feel overwhelmed so you don't do anything. You can, like you say, take an action, find a friend who might take an action with you. Remember that people like to believe that it is that they want you to think that there's nothing you can do. There's small ways that you can contribute. There's small ways that you can have your voice heard, and you can take action against folks who, like the other day, Starbucks has refused to acknowledge what is going on. So we were able to get our money out of our Starbucks card. They send it to us as a check. You can cancel your account and you can tell them why. They even ask you, what is the reason for you doing that? There's a lot of ways that you can take action mm-hmm. in ways that might not always be as obvious either. So.
And a lot of people have put a lot of hard work into providing those resources.
Yes.
So
yes.
Please check them out. But I've also been reading Ghost Story by Peter Straub, and I really don't know how I feel about it yet. I finished it, and I still have a lot of thoughts and feelings. But I would recommend, if you like books, I would recommend the horror genre. It's pretty fascinating, and I'm always looking for another book that's like really going to keep me locked into reading. So
write in with How to Cook a Mushroom.
Horror book recommendations, great. Too. Well, thank you so much for listening today. Again, so sorry we didn't get an episode out last week.
We'll get better at that.
We'll get better at that. If you liked this episode or any of our episodes in our catalog, please rate us and leave us a quick review. That means a lot to us. Reviews help new listeners figure out if they want to give us a try. So thank you so much in advance for leaving a quick positive review.
We also have a bookshop site. You can find all the books that we've ever recommended, like what Margaret just recommended, in one place at Bookshop. And this allows you to give a percentage of the books purchased to folks who tell or recommend them, like ourselves, and allows you to shop local with small bookstores, independent bookstores, at bookshop.com/shop. Dang it. Let me take that again.
Go ahead.
We'll cut that. bookshop.org/shop/don't-pee-on-your-leg.
You can find more from us on our social media pages, on Instagram at Don't Pee On Your Leg, at Facebook at facebook.com/don't-pee-on-your-leg.
Don't Pee On Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions. It's a podcast produced by Two Birds, One Scone. Articles, blog posts, and more about what you can do every day to conserve our environment can be found at www.twobirdsonescone.org.
Our original theme music is by Camillo.
And if you have a scientific misconception that you'd like explained or want to provide feedback to us or tell us about how to cook a mushroom or horror books, please email us at don'tpeeonyourleg@gmail.com.
Have a great week.